You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, DNR officials are saying that new numbers show Wisconsin's wolf population is stabilizing. We'll find out about trends over the years and how federal wolf protections could be affecting those numbers. Now, Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Secretary and CEO Mark Hogan is stepping down from his position officially next week. Hogan announced in June that he was planning on resigning and made it official this week with a letter to Governor Evers. Hogan's resignation coincides with the four-year anniversary of his appointment to the position by former Governor Scott Walker. During his tenure, WEDC oversaw a number of business development projects. The big one, the multi-billion dollar agreement with electronics manufacturer Foxconn. Mark Hogan joins us now to talk about his legacy with the agency and his hopes for business in Wisconsin in the future. Secretary Hogan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, why did you decide to step down from this position now?
Well, this is something that I had decided a year and a half ago. In January or February last year, the Governor Walker and his staff, as they would normally do during an election year, they check in with the cabinet secretaries, and they just want to make sure that they understand what their thought process is relative to staying on the job. And I don't think it matters if it's a Democrat or Republican governor. When you're in that election year, you don't want to have cabinet members leaving in September or October right before the election raises questions. So at that point, I had told Governor Walker that I was on through the election. I would go into this year had he been reelected. And then, but I would probably move on in the fall of this year. And I did not intend to go on for another 4 years. So when Governor Evers won the election, early on, after he had put WDC's funding back into his budget, which was proposed in early February, and people were asking him whether or not he would be willing to keep me on or if he would ask me to keep me on, I let him know that my decision wasn't going to change with Governor Evers. It was the same decision that I had with Governor Walker, but I just hadn't talked about it with anybody.
When you came on board at WEDC, it had some controversies, concerns in particular over oversight of loans the organization had given out, benchmarks that recipients of assistance from the agency were getting. What coming into that job 4 years ago, what kind of changes did you want to make?
Well, I wasn't really sure at the time, Rob. I certainly was aware of the situations, what I had read in the paper, but I knew that I had background in it. Financial services and banking. I'd been in banking for 38 years. I had come up through the credit side. I think I understood process. I understood the regulatory side of it. And I just went in and I listened. I listened to the staff and got their ideas as to things that we needed to do. And we started making those decisions and we started implementing some of those things. And over the course of the last 4 years, I'm very proud of the work that the WEDC staff has done about infrastructure, around infrastructure, internally, but also the work that we're doing externally with our partners throughout the state. But that was just it. When you go back to 2011 and when WEDC was created, it really was a startup. So there was naturally some maturation that had to take place over a period of time. And I picked it up at a good time and we were able to make changes. And I think the recent Legislative Audit Bureau report bears that out.
Looking at comments on our recent stories about your departure, I've seen critique from the left on the existence of the WEDC saying, you know, this is just the state funneling money to the corporations. There are also some complaints from the right saying, hey, the state shouldn't have this role meddling in the marketplace. What would you say to either side to say this organization is something that benefits the state?
Well, if you want to continue to grow as a state, you're going to have to grow from an economic development standpoint. I am a free markets person. I believe in free markets. But I also understand that I oversee an agency that awards millions of dollars in incentives each year throughout the state of Wisconsin. And the free market that we operate in right now is about incentives. So if every other state, or even if our bordering states, were not willing to offer incentives to companies that are within the state of Wisconsin, to go to their state, then I think you could say, well, then we can fall back and fall on the qualitative things that are important that we believe are truly important about the state. But at some point, incentives are part of that free market that exists today. Companies like John Deere and Horicon, Green Bay Packaging in Green Bay, Komatsu in Milwaukee had we not offered incentives to those companies, hundreds of jobs would have left the state. So, yes, from a purist standpoint, there are people that are going to disagree both on the left or the right, but it's just not practical to feel like the only thing that we have to offer it would be the qualitative, a lot of our quality of life aspects of Wisconsin.
Talking to Mark Hogan, he's the secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. For another 5 days or so, he attended his resignation, he says, as he had planned to do for some time now. Well, the biggest thing that happened during your tenure at WEDC was, of course, the Foxconn deal. Did you have any idea coming into this gig that you'd have this multi-billion dollar agenda item coming over your desk?
I've been asked that before, Rob, and I think my answer has always been, had I known that we were going to have this, I probably wouldn't have taken the job. No, you didn't. But I knew that the state was in a good position. At that point, Governor Walker and his administration had been in for 4 years. There were things that had taken place from a statewide perspective on economic development, whether it was right to work or it was prevailing wage, for example, the manufacturing agricultural tax credit. Those things set the state up well to be an attractive alternative to outside corporations. But no, never thought in a million years that something like Foxconn would be an opportunity for Wisconsin.
I've talked to some national analysts who say even if the Foxconn deal works out perfectly exactly as planned, on a dollar per job ratio and just with the amounts of incentives we're talking about, it's a really big thing, a lot of money going in for each job we create. Did we overspend on this?
We did not. We did not. I think that the investment over a long period of time will pay off. People want to take pot shots at how much we're paying on a per job basis. But a lot of these people are people that have never put a deal together either. And they have their own point of view, and that's fine. I just don't agree with it. I think that the contract that we have right now at WEDC and with the state of Wisconsin protects the taxpayers, and that's the most important thing from my perspective.
And we've seen the deal apparently changing or in flux. We hear different things from Foxconn over time as to what the final product is going to be. Do you worry sometimes that it's not going to be what you thought it was going to be when you signed this?
I think it's protected within the contract. I would say a couple of things, Rob. One is I know that Foxconn remains very committed to the state of Wisconsin. I've been in virtually every meeting that has taken place over the last 2.5 years, from the first time that Governor Walker and I met with them in the White House at the end of April of 2017. And even at every point forward, I know that the company has stated publicly that they're committed to the state. And the other side of that is I also know that Governor Evers is committed to and very much wants to have the company be successful in the state. And as I've said, I'm not going to get into the negotiations or conversations that I have with the company or with the administration. But I think if both are viewing it in that regard, and I firmly believe that they both are, I think that's a good starting point between the administration and the company.
There has been talk of a possible renegotiation of a deal. You wouldn't be part of that. I assume it's not going to happen in the next 5 days. Do you think the Foxconn Wisconsin deal needs a renegotiation?
That's not up for me to say. That's between the governor and the company and whoever my successor is at WEDC. And I don't comment on negotiations, whether they're taking place or they're not taking place. It doesn't matter if it's Foxconn or any other company that we've dealt with or I've dealt with over the last 4 years.
Looking to the future, what are your future hopes now, since you'll be watching kind of from the sidelines here when it comes to business development in Wisconsin?
Well, I'm encouraged by what I see. I think when I started at WEDC, what I realized was that within the organization, there were a lot of people, very smart people that worked hard. They liked having fun. They really knew what they were doing and very committed to public service and economic development in the state. And one of the things that I've seen over the last 4 years is, yes, we've got a great group at the state, but within the local and regional, our economic development partners at the local and regional level, it's very solid all throughout the state of Wisconsin. And they also are committed to growing from an economic development standpoint in the state. And that's what gives me a lot of comfort going forward. And really, I'm looking forward to seeing what that next chapter might be, because there are a lot of things that are going on in the state right now, and I think we're just starting to see the tip of the iceberg.
And what's next for you?
I'm going to take some time off and just see where it goes. My son Matt gets married a week from Saturday, and just see what happens after that. I wasn't looking for this job when it found me, and we'll see where we go. I'll play a little golf, hopefully, and just relax a bit. But I stay involved. I'm in nonprofit boards in the Milwaukee area. I enjoy that, and I look forward to more of that.
Secretary Hogan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mark Hogan, currently Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. He's stepping down from that position next week. He's with us to talk about his time with the WEDC and his hopes for business in the future in Wisconsin. Few animal populations in Wisconsin get more attention than the gray wolf. Some think the federal government should keep protecting the animals. Others point to issues like livestock attacks as a reason to delist wolves from the endangered species list. Now, the latest wolf count from the DNR shows that the population could be stabilizing. It comes as Wisconsin lawmakers continue to raise the issue of wolf management at the state and national levels. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter based in Superior. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
What are the new estimates of the wolf population, the gray wolf population here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so from their minimum count last winter, volunteer trackers reported between 914 and 978 wolves, and that's about a 1% increase from the last monitoring period.
And how does that fit into long-term trends with our wolf population in the state?
Well, if you look long term, like going back to 1980, the state had about 25 wolves, according to the DNR. And there's been long recovery efforts to help reestablish the wolf since it was listed on the endangered species list. And since then, we've really seen the wolf kind of just thrive here in Wisconsin. In the last three winter surveys, numbers have been pretty consistent around that 900 to 1,000 mark. And it looks like their population is stabilizing from the data that they've collected.
And in your reporting on this, going back, as you say, we were down to a couple dozen wolves at one point. But way back when, what do we think, or what's the understanding about how many wolves we used to have in Wisconsin?
At one time, there could have been as many as 5,000 wolves in the state, but they were hunted nearly to extinction when the state put a bounty on wolves under pressure from farmers.
And now we've got this number, as you said, in the mid-900s, plus or minus a little bit. Is there a thought that, okay, we've hit a plateau, we've got about as many wolves as the state, as it's currently laid out, is going to sustain?
Well, Scott Walter, the DNR large carnivore specialist, says that the data is an indication that wolves have reached their suitable range in the state, because as they've grown, as their population has grown, they are spreading southward from their typical northern range in northern Wisconsin. And when they do that, they encounter less forest cover, more agriculture, and more people. So they end up seeing more conflicts, so it just makes more sense for them to inhabit the northern part of the state, where there's a lot more forested area and places where they can thrive.
And do we know, how does the DNR go about counting our wolves?
The DNR goes about counting wolves by using citizen scientists, volunteer trackers, who go out from this period. It was April of last year to April of this year, and they count a lot during the winter to see what the numbers are.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. She's reported on the latest gray wolf numbers here in Wisconsin in the mid-900s or so, suggesting that the population is stabilizing over the years. Danny, sometimes the state counts things and it's no big deal, not a lot of controversy. That's not true with gray wolves. There is a lot of controversy about how many we have and what the right number is. What are some of the issues that the people you talk to brought up?
Yeah, I mean, it's an emotional issue for a lot of people. And, you know, from a scientific perspective, one scientist, Adrian Trevis, who is a professor of environmental studies at University of Wisconsin-Madison, has raised questions over how the DNR has gone about its wolf count. He claims that they're not being fully transparent or allowing independent verification of the wolf count since 2012. But the DNR has said that their wolf monitoring hasn't changed throughout the years. And there were some closed meetings that were held that were previously public, but that was due to concern, I guess, over getting information out there about wolf hotspots during the time when there was a wolf hunt in Wisconsin. So others believe that the DNR is going about its count, and it's a reasonable measure of the state's wolf population. Adrian Weidevin, he's a former DNR wildlife biologist, and he's chair of the Timberwolf Alliance Council. He thinks that they are fairly intensely done by the state agency. He says they're a reliable indicator of the growth of the population. So that's one part of it. And then you get into the whole other part of all of the emotion that goes into the conflicts that arise from wolves as they're growing, bumping up against livestock and communities in the state and how people feel about that.
And then at the national level, these numbers will be watched here in Wisconsin because there's this ongoing saga both in Congress and in courts about the, as you mentioned earlier, the endangered species status of the gray wolf. I don't think we have to go through all the twists and turns in the last bunch of years, Danny, but can you remind us of the back and forth on this?
Yeah, so back in 2011, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that they were going to delist the wolf. And so it was delisted in 2012, but there was a challenge to that, and essentially a federal judge placed the gray wolf back on the endangered species list in 2014. So that meant that the wolf hunt that the state had enacted during that time could no longer be held because it was once again a protected species. And that's one of the concerns for people who I guess are concerned about the wolf being delisted and those protections possibly being removed, is that management returning to the states, not so much that as it is the wolf hunt. There were 654 wolves that were killed during the three seasons that it was held here in the state. And, you know, environmental groups, animal groups don't really think that that is the appropriate way to go for management. You know, they do think that there's like some common ground there that you could have where if you have a problem wolf, you can take care of that. Right now, with it being listed, you really can't do that with non-lethally anyway. Or lethally, I mean, you can't kill a wolf because that would be illegal because it's listed. So they have to use non-lethal measures like flagging or other ways to try and discourage wolf from depredating livestock or interfering with dogs or hounds.
And over the years, I understand Wisconsin's congressional delegation has gotten involved. I don't know about passing laws in Congress, but they've advocated, some members of Congress from Wisconsin advocated for delisting the wolf. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, Congressman Sean Duffy, who's going to be resigning pretty soon, has been a proponent of delisting the wolf. Also, Senator Tammy Baldwin signed on to legislation to delist the wolf, noting the conflicts that it's caused and saying that the wolf has been recovered in this region. And there's just a lot of debate among the wildlife and scientific community about whether the wolf has really recovered. I think state wildlife managers will definitely say that the wolf has recovered in Wisconsin. The fact that we're seeing stable numbers the past several years points to that their population is doing well and leveling off. But others, like animal groups and the Humane Society of the United States, will say, you know, it really hasn't recovered to its historic range, and it threatens the recovery of this wolf if we were to delist it.
And Danny, does the state, do wildlife managers have a number in mind, like the right minimum number of gray wolves here in the state?
So the last time they changed their plan, I believe it was in 1999. And that's, about 20 years ago. And right then they had a population goal of 350 animals. And at that time, there were fewer wolves here in Wisconsin. So that seemed like a reasonable goal. Now we have, you know, more than 900 wolves that have been counted here in the state. And the state has said that if the wolf were delisted, they would revisit that management plan for the wolf and likely update that goal if it is delisted.
And Danny, over the years, we've had a lot of call-in segments related to the gray wolf and its listing as an endangered species. And one argument I've heard definitely is from people in northern Wisconsin saying, hey, people who are opposed to a wolf hunt or shooting wolves that commit depredations on livestock, they don't get what it's like. They're not living with it. Do you feel like this is that has that sort of personal element to it, that regional element to it in your neck of the woods?
Well, I mean, there's definitely going to be more conflicts where you see more wolves. And for the people that are directly impacted by that, it's very significant, especially if it's their livelihood that's at stake. So I don't think that should be discounted. But at the same time, you know, if you look at it from a tribal perspective, the wolf is seen as a brother by some tribes. And so there's just a lot of emotion that surrounds this animal, and it's never been really easy to decide how we should go about managing it.
It's a good place to leave it. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter for WPR News based in Superior. She joins to talk about a new wolf count in Wisconsin that shows the population could be stabilizing after 20 years of growth. Another fast food chain is experimenting with fake meat. On Tuesday, Kentucky Fried Chicken offered meatless nuggets and wings at a single restaurant in Atlanta. People gobbled them up. According to Veg News, customers wrapped around two city blocks and waited in line for more than an hour. They were sold out in less than 5 hours. Burger King, White Castle, and Red Robin have already rolled out plant-based meat alternatives, with more restaurants planning to follow suit. There are estimates that this could end up being a $2.5 billion industry by 2023. What is driving this trend? Dina Shanker is a food reporter for Bloomberg. Dina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, these meat substitute products, there have been ones on the market for a lot of years, you know, in the freezer section, grain burgers and fake meat products, but it seems like they're exploding. What happened?
Well, the food got a lot better. That's the first thing. Basically, the old school veggie burgers, they are still there, the Boca Burgers, the Morningstar Farms, but the new generation of plant-based burgers, they don't necessarily qualify as veggie burgers, kind of depends on who you talk to, but the new generation is made to really mimic beef and the other meats. So they are, instead of being frozen, they're usually sold fresh. They look like beef. They are supposed to taste and cook a lot more like beef than any of their predecessors ever did.
Now, I've used the phrase fake meat a couple times. You've talked to a lot of people in the industry. I assume that's not a phrase they love.
You assume correctly.
What do they tend to call it?
Plant-based meat is the term of choice that I hear the most.
Now, talk about how this is getting into, you know, not just the health food store or the health food section of the big groceries, but, you know, big fast food chains.
Yeah, well, we've seen two main companies that are really dominating the space. The first is Beyond Meat, and the second is Impossible Foods. And they took very different paths to market. So Beyond Meat started in Whole Foods and on university and hospital campuses. Then they went into more mainstream supermarkets. Then eventually they started going into the big national chains. TGI Fridays was their first one. Then you have Impossible, which went a very different way. They started with chefs at high-end restaurants like Momofuku in New York City, a bunch in San Francisco. And from there, they started going into high-end burger chains like Umami Burger and Bear Burger. And then the fast food, White Castle, was their first one. And they may start being sold in supermarkets next month.
What are the main ingredients going into our plant-based meat-like products?
So for Beyond Burgers, their main ingredient is a pea protein. And for Impossible Burgers, their main ingredient is soy, but it's their secret ingredient called heme, for short. Soyla hemoglobin is the full name. That is the ingredient that they say really gives it its meatiness, its taste, its texture, and it also gives it the red color.
Talking to Dina Shanker, food reporter for Bloomberg, looking at the rise of alternative, plant-based alternative meat products ending up in Burger King and other fast food chains, KFC trying one out now. Dina, who are the consumers driving this demand? What do they want?
So the consumers are surprisingly generally meat eaters. These aren't just vegetarians and vegans, although they're definitely eating this stuff too. But it's really the vast majority are meat eaters that appear to be looking for something healthier now. They might not be getting anything healthier, but that's what they're looking for, and that's why they're trying these products.
Yeah, that health issue, Whole Foods CEO John Mackey had said he's a vegan. He loves this is good for the environment, he thinks. He loves it's not meat. He doesn't think it's that good for your health. It's highly processed food stuff. You talked to us, in your extensive reporting, you've talked to some health expert types. What do they say?
That basically, from a health perspective, if there are any benefits, and that's a big if, then they would be very marginal. That for the most part, what you're looking at is something that is nutritionally pretty close to beef.
And John Mackey and some others have said, okay, that's not the benefit. It's not the health. It's maybe the sustainability, the environment. Is there an argument for that?
Oh, well, that is absolutely true. Beef is a major driver of man-made greenhouse gases. And anytime you can sub in a plant for beef, you're going to be doing the planet a favor.
And I had seen reporting, and I think it might have been yours, Dina, that at least one of these big companies with these new burgers is trying to steer clear of the V word on their packaging and marketing, vegan. It is vegan, but that's not really their selling point, right?
Yeah, you know, a lot of these companies want to be sure that they're appealing to the masses, and vegans make up a tiny percentage of consumers, and that's not who they're going for. So by calling it a vegan product, I think these companies worry about losing appeal to meat eaters.
All right, an anecdote for you. A source close to me, my wife, ordered one of these at a restaurant once and was in the process of being about to send it back. She's like, wait a minute, this is beef. And the wait staff was clearly like used to this, like, no, it's the thing. This is pretty beef like, right?
So anecdotally, I've heard that story before.
Yes.
It's apparently so common. Like, I've heard it from consumers, I've heard it just yesterday. I heard it from a chef at a Sodexo chef, Sodexo, the food service company.
Now, we see these products marketed as burgers of various sorts. I think there's a brat out there. There are dogs. There are legal questions, right? You've written about legal challenges in some states to whether a non-meat product can use these words used to describe meat.
That's right. We're seeing some legislation pop up state by state. It seems to be pushed by the cattle industry. And sometimes you actually have a state legislator who is himself a cattleman. So there's definitely a lot of push towards this legislation that would limit the use of words like meat, sausage, beef, anything like that to a product that comes from a slaughtered animal. So if it's a plant-based burger, then they can't call it a plant-based burger. I don't know, plant-based patty maybe? It's a battle that's ongoing. A couple of states have actually passed these laws, and there are some lawsuits to try to stop them from going into effect.
That said, are there companies that are associated with some form of meat production who are going with the, if you can't beat them, join them? Are they trying to diversify into these alternatives?
Absolutely. Tyson Foods said that they will be coming out with a new line called Raised and Rooted, and it will include a couple of things that aren't, they're not vegan products, actually, but they are moving in that direction. There's a faux chicken nugget, but it has a little bit of egg white in it, and then there's a 50-50 burger that will be a half beef and half pea protein burger. And then you also have Smithfield, which is the world's largest pork producer, and they have a line of soy-based meat alternatives coming out. And then you also have the big CPG companies, the big consumer packaged good companies like Nestle has a new burger coming, and ConAgra under their Gardein brand. So all the big players are hopping in.
Did I see somebody quote in one of your pieces say something about if you want to make somebody think they're really eating meat and it's not meat, there's a bratwurst product? Because we're really interested in this here in Wisconsin, Dina.
Yeah, it was actually the founder of Bear Burger who told me that he thought that Beyond's bratwurst was the closest thing you'll ever get, or out there right now anyway, to fooling a meat eater, that the sausage just really, really tastes like pork sausage.
We're talking about the growing fake meat industry, or plant-based meat alternative industry, if you will, with Dina Shenker. She's a food reporter with Bloomberg, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about plant-based meat? Is it appealing to you, or sacrilege in the kitchen? Have you tried one of these Impossible Burger or Beyond Burgers? Did it seem like the real deal, like an actual beef burger to you? Have you tried these? Do you serve them if you work or own work at or own a restaurant? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about America's growing appetite for non-meat meats, plant-based meat alternatives. Kentucky Fried Chicken taste-tested a plant-based chicken substitute in Atlanta this week. Other restaurants, including fast food joints like Burger King, Red Robin, and White Castle, have introduced plant-based burgers. They're making their way to stores more and more as well. Dina Shenker is our guest food reporter for Bloomberg, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of meat substitutes or intrigued by them? If you're a vegetarian, do you want things that replicate the experience of eating meat? Or is that kind of gross and defeating the purpose? If you're not a vegetarian, do you eat something in place of a meat patty between burger buns sometimes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Andrew starts us off in Green Bay. Andrew, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
What do you think?
So I'm a beginning farmer in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I went to school and got a master's degree in ecology, and I decided that coming back and raising 100% grass-fed beef, pastured pork, and pastured laying hens was the most effective way of imitating the natural environments that I studied. So what I'm concerned about with these plant-based meat products is the environmental implication of growing vast amounts of annual crops that would otherwise be rangeland or just wildland for non-food animals, where otherwise we could be growing grass-fed beef and all these other things. And I don't want to, I don't support the way that we traditionally raise beef and pigs in confinement or anything like that. That's part of the reason I do the grass-fed, so that we can mimic their natural behaviors and preserve the natural environment as much as we can.
So. Andrew, thanks so much for calling and sharing your experience with this. And Dina, I don't think Andrew's probably alone with this. He's saying, hey, let's stick with meat, but grow it in more sustainable ways as opposed to finding alternatives to meat.
Yeah. So first of all, Andrew, big hats off to you. You have a really, really hard and demanding job. I grew up in farm country. I've been around farmers my whole life, and I know you guys are probably some of the most hardworking people out there. Now, when it comes to these plant-based alternatives, I think that I don't think of them as an alternative to the grass-fed, more naturally raised kind of meats that you say you grow. I think that they are more so an alternative, especially when they're sold at a place like White Castle or Burger King. They're an alternative to the more commodity type of meat. And it takes a lot less soy to make an Impossible Burger, for example, than it does to make a beef burger. So I think if the concern is about the land that goes to growing agricultural products, that plant-based meats are probably not the right place to start looking to reduce.
Thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Stacy now in Eau Claire. Stacy, hi.
Hi. I just want to echo a lot of Andrew's comments. My husband and I also raise grass-fed beef, but I think one of the things people don't consider about the conventionally raised pea and soy is that those agricultural crops require so many inputs, too. So you have a lot of gas to till those fields, and then you have all the herbicides and pesticides and fertilizers and everything that's going on to those plants that people are eating and thinking are quote-unquote healthier, but they're not necessarily healthier. They have a lot of chemical inputs, and they're polluting our groundwater and our environment every day.
Stacey, thanks a lot for the call. We've got all of our grass-fed beef farmers in Wisconsin calling in, Dina. But again, the concern, it sounds like, is it's not comparing the meat, the grass-fed meat that she's raising. It's comparing the mass-produced meat that's probably eating agricultural products that use the same things that she was just talking about on their crops.
Yeah, but you know, I'll add a couple of points. The first is that on the environmental concerns, I've heard these concerns and I understand them completely, especially when we're talking about genetically modified soy that's usually grown with a lot of glyphosate, which is really detrimental to the environment. However, it's still the same comparison in that. It takes a lot less soy to make an Impossible Burger than to make a beef burger. So even if a GMO soy is arguably not a perfect ingredient, it's still a lot less than it would go into a standard beef burger. The other thing that I should mention is that in terms of grass-fed beef, that we simply don't have enough land in this country to raise all of our beef grass-fed. So it's not an answer to the question of where is all that beef going to come from. We can't do it all by grass-fed. And so that's another reason why I think a lot of environmentalists point to these plant-based burgers.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dita Shanker, food reporter for Bloomberg, about the rise of plant-based meat alternatives finding their way now into big fast food chains, Burger King the biggest so far. Before we go back to the callers, Dina, let's talk about that so far. Everybody's watching McDonald's, right?
That's right. Yeah, McDonald's is the biggest fish.
And is there anybody out there at this point who could meet the demand to supply these things without running out of them for a chain the size of McDonald's?
So Beyond Meat CEO Ethan Brown said in his company's first earnings call when he was asked about McDonald's that he didn't think that there was any customer out there that would break their system. I think that they would approach it in an incremental kind of way so that they weren't going from zero to 33,000 overnight. They say they can do it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Julia is with us in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on. Just a couple things. I've been a vegetarian for 40 years. One, I'm excited to see the prices drop for meatless items. I think it will be good for us individuals that have been buying for a long time that we see higher prices for vegetarian items. Secondly, I heard some of the callers calling in regards to, the pros and cons of these veggie burgers versus beef burgers. But one thing to think about is that, I'll eat a number of Boca burgers over the years versus somebody eating beef burgers over the years. Who is going to be more prone to heart disease?
Julia, thanks for the call. Jury's out on that one, Dina, right? Or at least the health officials aren't saying that the veggie burger is going to necessarily be that much better in the long run than the beef burger.
One of the things that one health impact of red meat that has been linked by scientists in a number of studies has been questions is red meat causing heart disease, obesity, cancer? There are a lot of health conditions that there may be higher risk for people that eat a lot of red meat. And that is one thing that dietitians do sometimes point out that may be a benefit of eating these foods, which is why when I say that any health impact, if there is one, would probably be marginal, because if you're talking about a risk, it's already a question whether this health impact of red meat is really there. It may be, it may not. It hasn't been 100% established. And also it kind of depends on how often are you making these substitutions.
And but to her main point, life is getting easier for vegetarians these days, it sounds like, Dina.
It absolutely is. There was a time when you could not go into a restaurant and find something vegetarian to eat. So now it just seems like it's becoming more and more common, you know, not even just to have one of these burgers on the menu, but that they will make, they'll put something on the menu for people that don't want to eat meat that meal.
Time for one more call. Let's bring Mike on in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hi there, guys. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call as always, Rob.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Mike?
Well, there's just a couple of things I want to say. Number one, this is going to be jokingly. My thought process on this, I'm the grandson of a butcher, and if I, you know, if this goes through life as I'm eating this sort of stuff, my biggest fear is I'm going to hear a thump, thump, thump from a graveyard somewhere in northeast Wisconsin. But anyway, on a more serious note, I do have a legitimate concern. I've seen, like, the Impossible Whopper come out and what have you. The thing I don't see is exactly any clarification, unless you do some digging, as to what the ingredients are. Now, my biggest problem is I'm allergic to soy protein. Mm. I can have soy sauce, you know, vegetable oil, which is soybean oil. I can do
Mike,
that.
Mike, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. I think we get the point. Do we know, Dina, are people worried about allergies with these products?
Yes. I mean, soy is an allergen, and some people have raised that concern.
All right, Mike, thanks, and good luck. Dina, what are you watching for next in our last half a minute or so when it comes to the meat alternative market?
Well, we know the KFC Beyond Meat partnership in Atlanta was a big success, so I want to know when they're going to roll it out nationally.
Dina, we'll leave
whether they'll sell them in supermarkets, too.
Thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Dina Shanker, food reporter for Bloomberg. We talked to her about the growing industry of plant-based meat substitutes. Still time for you to weigh in. Would you eat or have you eaten a burger or chicken-like substance made of peas, soy, and or mung beans? Or does it have to be actual meat for you? How do you feel about the rise of these plant-based meat alternatives? Share your comments, your reviews, maybe, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Well, speaking of diet and nutrition, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a doctor tells us the American-style diet is leading to a lot of our healthcare problems and healthcare costs around the country, but says that better food policies, especially at the federal level, could help move us all in a healthier direction. We'll find out why one state is passing a law aimed at cracking down on fake service animals. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Forget that health talk earlier. We're going to talk about cookies and cake. A cookbook author tells us how to do some bigger, bolder baking. There's a bread pudding, a chocolate bread pudding recipe on the horizon that I'm really interested in. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.